followed and cared for your children, and to hell with your little subterfuge.
Hawthorne stubbed out his cigarette, the ash sparking red.
But at the very moment, you and Mary came to some sort of an agreement. Traverton told us that Mary was staring into his eyes, but he was wrong about that. You were staring at Alan, who was standing right next to him. You were telling him to get the hell out. Is that right?
There was nothing he could do. Mary echoed the words that Alan had just spoken. She had a face like death, with tears glistening on both cheeks. She was staring into the mid-distance. Later on, I would be sickened that all this had happened in my home. I would wish that they had never come here.
I sort of understand why you've stayed with the family all these years, Mary, Hawthorne concluded. It's because you know you were responsible for what happened. Is that right? Or is it because you're still shagging Alan?
For God's sake. Godwin was furious. We ended that years ago. Mary is there for Jeremy. Only for Jeremy.
Yeah. And Jeremy is there because of Mary. The two of you really are made for each other.
What do you want from us? Godwin asked. Do you think we haven't been punished enough for what happened that day? He closed his eyes for a moment, then continued. It was just bad luck. If I hadn't come out of the shop at that moment, if the boys hadn't seen me. He was speaking very slowly, his tone almost matter-of-fact. All I've ever cared about is that Judith should never find out, he said. It was bad enough losing Timothy and Jeremy. But if she knew about Mary and me, he stopped. Are you going to tell her?
I'm not going to tell her anything. It's none of my business.
Then why did you bring us here?
Because I needed to know I was right about the two of you. You want my advice? I tell your wife about what happened. She's already thrown you out. Your marriage is over. But this thing, this secret you've had between you, is cancer. It's eating you up. I'd cut it out.
Alan Godwin nodded slowly, then got to his feet. Mary O'Brien did the same. They moved towards the door, but at the last moment, Godwin turned back. You're a clever man, Mr. Hawthorne, he said. But you have no understanding at all about what we've been through. You have no feelings. We made a horrible mistake, and we've had to live with it every day. But we're not monsters, we're not criminals. We were in love.
But Hawthorne wasn't having any of it. It seemed to me that his face was paler and his eyes more vengeful than ever. You wanted sex. You were cheating on your wife. And because of that, a child died.
Alan Godwin stared at him with something close to disgust. Mary had already passed through the door. He spun on his heel and followed her. We were left alone.
Did you have to be so hard on them? I asked at length.
Hawthorne shrugged.
You feel sorry for them?
I don't know. Yes, maybe. I tried to gather my thoughts. Alan Godwin didn't kill Diana Cooper.
That's right. He doesn't blame her for the accident and deal. He blames himself. So he had no reason to kill her. She was just the instrument of what happened, not the cause.
And the driver of the car?
It doesn't matter who was driving the car. Damien, his mother, the lady next door. It's got nothing to do with it.
Cigarette smoke hung in the air. I would have to explain that to my wife later. I was still sitting on the piano stool. My number one theory about the murder had just crashed to the ground. So if the killer wasn't Alan Godwin, who was it? I asked. Where do we go next?
Grace Lavelle, Hawthorne replied. We'll see her tomorrow.
20. An Actor's Life. Grace Lavelle had not returned to the flat in Brick Lane, and I can't say I blamed her. It would take a long time to wipe away all the blood that had been spilled, and longer still to erase the memories of so much violence. She and Ashley were staying at her parents' home in Hounslow, close to Heathrow Airport, where her father worked as a senior commercial manager. Martin Lavelle had taken the day off. He was a large, intimidating man, wearing a polo shirt that was too small for him, with shoulders straining at the fabric and butcher's arms bursting out of the sleeves. He had shaved his head, which made it difficult to guess his age, but he must have been in his late 50s. Grace didn't look anything like him. He was holding Ashley and had to be careful to concentrate on what he was doing. I could easily imagine him accidentally smothering the little girl in his bear-like embrace. As usual, she was showing no interest in what was going on, absorbed in the pages of a rag book. The house was clean and modern, part of an estate which must have been perfectly aligned with the main runway, as we were deafened every few minutes by the roar of the planes taking off. Grace and her father didn't appear to notice the noise. Ashley positively enjoyed it, giggling with pleasure every time a plane went past. Grace had told us that Rosemary Lavelle, her mother, was at work, teaching maths at a local secondary school. This left the five of us sitting awkwardly close to each other on sofas and armchairs that were rather too big for the room. Martin had offered us coffee, which we had refused. He sat quietly while Grace did most of the talking. From time to time, I noticed him watching us with a strange, smouldering anger in his eyes. Over the next 20 minutes, Grace described her life with Damien Cooper, how they had met, their relationship, their time in America. She was quite different from how she had been the last few times we had met her, as if Damien's death had released her from some sort of obligation. As she talked, I realized that she had fallen out of love with him a long time ago, and I remembered Hawthorne sarcastically dismissing her as the grieving widow. Well, he'd been right about that. She'd been the actress all along, and this was her moment in the spotlight. I don't mean to be unkind. I liked her. She was young and charismatic, and she had allowed her life to be stolen away from her. Although she never said as much, it was clear that Damien's death would give her a chance to start again. This is what she said.
I always wanted to be an actress, for as long as I can remember. I loved drama class when I was at school, and I went to the theatre whenever I could afford it. I'd go to the National first thing in the morning and queue up for £10 seats, or I'd get tickets right at the back of the top circle. I worked part-time in a hairdressing salon in the school holidays so I could afford it, and Mum and Dad were brilliant. They always supported me. When I told them I wanted to apply to RADA, they were 100% behind me.
I tried to talk you out of it, Martin Lavelle growled.
You came into town with me, Daddy. When I had my first audition, you sat in that pub round the corner.
She turned back to us.
I was 18 years old, and I'd just taken my A-levels. Dad wanted me to go to university and apply when I finished, but I couldn't wait. I had 4 auditions, and they got more and more difficult. The last one was the worst. There were 30 of us, and we were there for the whole day. We had to do a whole lot of classes, and all the time, we knew we were being watched by all these different people, and that at least half of us wouldn't be coming back. I felt sick with nerves. But of course, if I'd shown it, that would have been the end for me. And then, a few days later, I got a telephone call from the head of RADA. He actually rings everyone, personally, to say that I'd been accepted, and it was like, oh my God, that's impossible. It was all my dreams come true. Then, of course, I had to work out how to pay for it. Dad said he'd put up half the money, which was amazing.
I did it because I believed in you,
Martin muttered, contradicting what he had said a moment before.
But I still had to find the other half. There hadn't been local authority grants for 5 years, and I couldn't borrow the money, so there was a time when I was really worried I wouldn't be able to go. In the end, RADA helped me out. There was a famous actor, they never told me his name, and he wanted to support someone who was just starting out. Maybe it helped that I was back. I heard they were keen to have a proper ethnic mix, so half my fees were taken care of, and the following September, I began. I loved being at RADA. I loved every minute of it. Sometimes I felt completely exposed. It was an incredibly tense atmosphere, and they made us work really hard. There were only 28 of us in the year, and a couple of students, a Scottish boy and a girl from Hong Kong, dropped out, so it was very intimate, but at the same time you had to make yourself vulnerable. That was part of the training. There were times when I thought I just couldn't do it, and I'd go home and cry, but then a teacher would encourage me, or my friends would support me, and somehow I'd get through it, and I'd be stronger when I came out on the other side. You want to know about Damien? You have to understand that we were very close as a group. We all loved each other. We really did. And we weren't competitive at all. At least not until the very end when we had to do our tree and the agents were circling. What's a tree? I asked. Oh, it's a showcase.
You have to perform short scenes and monologues, and lots of agents come to see your work. It's named after the actor Beerbohm Tree. She picked up her train of thought. At the beginning, of course, everyone got into different cliques. There were three girls from the north of England. We were all a bit scared of them. There were a couple of gay guys. Some of the students were older, in their late 20s, and they felt more comfortable with each other. To begin with, I was completely on my own. I remember sitting in a big circle on the first day, thinking to myself that these were the people I was going to spend the next 3 years of my life with, and I didn't know any of them. I was terrified. But then, as I say, we got closer, and almost from the very start, if there was one person who stood out, it was Damien. Everyone knew him. Everyone admired him. He was the same age as me, and he had hardly ever been in London. He lived in Kent. But he had this extraordinary confidence, and the teachers were all over him. Nobody said he was a star. It didn't work like that. But Damien always got the best casting and the best feedback, and everyone wanted to be his best friend. Somehow, that ended up being me. We didn't sleep together, by the way. Well, we did once, but it's like I told you, we only got together after we'd left quite a few years later. Damien and me were very close, but there was another girl he fancied, Amanda Lee, although Damien always said that wasn't a real name. She was crazy about the actress Vivian Lee, and people said she changed her name to be more like her. I'll tell you a bit more about her later. So there was Damien and Amanda and me and another boy, Dan Roberts, who was also a brilliant actor. A lot of people thought that Damien and Dan were into each other, but that wasn't true. The four of us were best friends, and we stayed that way for the whole time we were there. It was only after we left that we all went our separate ways, but I suppose that's the business. My first job was with the Citizens Theatre in Glasgow. Damien was with the RSC, Dan was in Twelfth Night in Bristol, and I can't remember what Amanda did, but the main thing is we were apart. I could talk to you all day about RADA. What I remember most is just this sense of belonging, of being with the right people in exactly the right place. They made us work incredibly hard, movement classes, voice classes, singing classes, and you had a ton of homework too. Nobody ever had any money. That was a funny thing. We'd hang out in this disgusting cafe called Sid's, and all the boys would be eating huge plates of chips and sausages and stuff like that because it was cheap. Some nights we'd go drinking at the Marlborough Arms. That was the pub where you waited for me, Daddy. But mainly, everyone just went home and did their Lloyd or whatever else they had to do and then crashed out. I had no idea what doing a Lloyd meant, but this time I didn't interrupt. But if you're interested in Damien, then I have to tell you about the third year production of Hamlet, because that was when everything sort of came to a head. It was a really, really important production. First of all, because it was Hamlet, and whoever got that role was going to have a fantastic launch pad. Loads of agents would be there, and it was going to be directed by Lindsay Posner, who'd done a whole load of great work at the Royal Court, and we'd all seen his brilliant American Buffalo at the Young Vic. Everyone thought that Dan would get cast. He'd only had small parts in the last two productions, and the rumour was that he'd been held back on purpose because he was going to be given this great chance to shine. Also, his tree hadn't gone as well as expected. He'd fluffed some of his lines, so it was his turn. We were all excited, waiting for the list to go up. There was a tiny, cramped space near the pigeonholes where they'd put up the cast list, and everyone would crowd around to see who was going to play what and which theatre was going to be used. By now, we were getting nervous too. We'd been there for 3 years, and we were getting close to the end. The worst thing that could happen to you was to leave RADA without an agent, so these last productions really mattered. Anyway, the list went up, and sure enough, Dan was cast as Hamlet. I got Ophelia, which was fantastic. Amanda only got a tiny part as Osric. They were going to do it cross-gender. She only turned up in Act 5, but she played Imogen in Cymbeline earlier in the year, so that was fair enough. Damien was going to play Laertes, and he was happy about that, although a lot of people said he should have been Hamlet. He'd done the rogue and peasant slave soliloquy for his tree, and everyone said it was awesome. The production was going to be in modern dress, and it was being staged in the GBS Theatre, which was down in the basement, and it was the coolest space in the building, much cooler than the Vanbrugh. We had 5 weeks of rehearsals, which sounds a lot, but it was incredibly demanding. And then, 1 week in, everything changed. And the reason I'm telling you about this is that you could say, it's what changed my life. Dan got ill with glandular fever and couldn't come to rehearsals. So after a lot of discussion, he changed parts with Damien, which meant that suddenly Damien and I were working together for hours and hours on all these incredibly intense scenes. When I look back on it, that's when I fell in love with him. When he was on the stage, he had this magnetism. I mean, he was impressive when you met him in the street, but when he was performing, it was like looking into a pool of water or a well. He had a depth and a sort of clarity. Lindsay Posner loved working with him, and that was how he got into the RSC. Lindsay was doing a whole lot of work at Stratford and the Barbican, and he took Damien with him. People still talk about that production of Hamlet. Damien, Dan and I all got agents as a result of it, and the artistic director told me it was one of the best he'd ever seen. We did it in the round, with no set and very few props. We used a lot of masks. Lindsay had been very influenced by No Theatre. There was no doubt that Damien was brilliant. He stole the show. Dan was great, too. You could feel the energy and the violence in the fight scene in Act 5. It was done with fans, not with swords. We actually got a standing ovation, and that's something that doesn't happen often at RADA, not with agents in the audience. But I remember it mainly because of Damien. You must know the play, Act 3, Scene 1. I was in tears at the end of it. Oh, what a noble mind is here, O throne. All the suffering and the madness in the scene stayed with me. At one moment, Damien grabbed me by the throat, and his face was so close to mine I could feel his breath on my lips. When he let me go, he left bruises. After we'd got together, he said he didn't want to act with me again. But by then, my acting career was on hold, anyway, because of Ashley. I suppose what I'm trying to say is that what I loved most was the actor more than the man. As a man, he could be... She couldn't find the word she was looking for, so her father supplied it. A bastard. Dad. The way he treated you, the way he used you. He wasn't always like that. He and his mother were like that from the very start, both of them, as bad as each other. Grace looked at him disapprovingly, but she didn't argue with him. And then she was off again. I was signed up by Independent Talent, and my first job was an appearance in a TV show, Jonathan Creek. I only had a few lines. I played a magician's assistant. But at least it was something on my CV. I got a few other jobs in TV, Casualty, Holby City, The Bill, and I did an advert for Stella Artois, which was amazing. I got to spend a week in Buenos Aires. I also started getting a lot of theatre. My best job was the Jonathan Kent season at the Haymarket. I had good parts in The Country Wife and a play by Edward Bond, The Sea. I even got a mention in the reviews. Fiona Brown, my agent, was certain things were going to happen for me. I was getting some great auditions, too. And then I met Damien again. He came to see The Country Wife. He hadn't even realised I was in it, but he had a friend who was playing Mrs. Fidget. We bumped into each other backstage and went out for a drink. It was terrible, really. I mean, we'd known each other and we'd been so close, yet we hadn't seen each other for years and years. That was him, Martin Lavelle said. Ashley had finished the rag book and fallen asleep in his arms. He laid her gently on the sofa. All he cared about was his career. He never had friends. He used you. Don't say that, Daddy. Grace still wasn't disagreeing with him. Damien was quite famous by now, I mean. People recognised his face, even if they weren't queuing up for autographs. He'd been in a lot of big films and TV shows, and he'd got an award from the Evening Standard. He was already working in Hollywood. He was about to start shooting Star Trek. I saw at once that he was different. He was harder than I remembered. He had a sort of steel edge to him that might have come with being so rich and so successful. He just bought the flat on Brick Lane, but actually I think a lot of it was a sort of defence. You've got to be hard in this business. I'd say it's part of an actor's life. We had a wonderful evening. Everyone loved the play, and there was a real buzz in the air. We had far too much drink, and we started talking about RADA and all the times we'd had together. Damien had worked with a couple of people from the school. He told me that Dan had dropped out of acting, which is a shame because he was super talented, but that's how it goes sometimes. You get offered tiny parts or understudies, but the big auditions never quite click. Dan very nearly got the main part in Pirates of the Caribbean. In the end, it went to Orlando Bloom. He also just missed out on Dr. Zhivago for ITV. Amanda had disappeared, of course. Damien talked a lot about himself. Star Trek was paying him enough to put a deposit on a house in Los Angeles, and he was thinking about moving out there altogether. He was in England for 3 weeks filming a miniseries, and we spent almost all that time together. I thought his flat in Brick Lane was amazing. I was sharing a tiny house in Clapham with two other actors, and this was like another world. His phone never stopped ringing. It was his agent, his manager, his publicist, a newspaper, a radio station. I realised that this was the dream that I'd had in my head when I went to RADA, except that for him, it was real. It'll be real for you too, Grace, now that he's gone. That's not fair, Dad. Damien never stood in my way. He got you pregnant just when your career was about to take off. It was my choice. She turned to us. When I told him the news, Damien said he wanted to have a baby with me. He was thrilled. He asked me to move in with him. He said he had more than enough money for both of us and the baby. He told me to get on the next flight to LA.
Did the two of you get married?
Hawthorne asked. Unusually for him, he had been silent throughout Grace's testimony, although he had been listening intently. No, we never did. Damien didn't think there was any point.
Damien was thinking of Damien, her father insisted. He didn't want to be tied down. And his mother was just as bad. All she cared about was her precious son. She never gave you the time of day.
We both made the decision, Dad, you know that. And Diana wasn't that bad. She was just lonely and a bit sad and thought the world of him.
She went over to Ashley and brushed the hair out of her eyes. Then she continued.
I did what he told me. He sent me the ticket.
Premium economy. He wouldn't even pay business class.
And I moved in with him. His agents managed to get us a visa. I don't know how they did that, but as things turned out, Ashley was born in America, and she even has American citizenship. Damien was already shooting Star Trek when I arrived, so I didn't see a lot of him, but I didn't mind. I helped him find the house that he bought. It only had two bedrooms, but it was a lovely little place high up in the hills with wonderful views and a tiny pool. I loved it. He let me decorate it the way I wanted. I had a baby room decorated for Ashley, and I went shopping in West Hollywood and Rodeo Drive. Damien came home late sometimes, but we had weekends together, and he introduced me to all his friends, and I thought everything was going to be all right. She looked down, and just for a moment I saw the sadness in her eyes. Only it wasn't. It was my fault, really. I didn't much like Los Angeles, even though I tried to. The trouble is, it's not really a city at all. You have to get in the car to go anywhere, but actually there isn't anywhere to go. I mean, it's shops and it's restaurants and it's the beach, but somehow it all just feels a bit pointless. It was always too hot, particularly when I was pregnant. I found myself spending more and more time on my own in the house. I said that Damien introduced me to his friends, but he didn't actually have that many of them, and they were always gossiping about the work they were doing, so inevitably I felt left out. They were mainly Brits, mainly actors. It's funny out there, people seem to have their own little circles, and they're not unfriendly, but they don't want to let you in. And I was homesick. I missed Mum and Dad, I missed London, I missed my career. Damien and me didn't have fights, but we weren't completely happy together. It seemed to me that he was quite different from the Damien I'd known at RADA. Maybe it was because he was getting so famous. He'd come home and he'd be glad to see me, and sometimes we'd be close, but I often thought it was all just an act. He was always telling me about the famous people he'd met. Chris Pine and Leonard Nimoy and J.J. Abrams. And of course I was just sitting at home, and that made me resentful. I wanted to be a mother, but I wanted to be more than that too. Ashley was born, and that was magical, and Damien had a big party, and he was the proud dad, but after that I found that he was away more and more. He'd been cast in season 4 of Mad Men, and his whole life seemed to be about parties, premieres, fast cars and models, while I was stuck at home with feeding bottles, prams and nappies, or diapers I should call them. He was getting through the money like nobody's business. There was never enough for the gardeners and the grocery bills. It was like some cheap paperback version of Hollywood. All the clichés.
Tell them about the drugs, her father said.
He took cocaine and other stuff, but that wasn't anything special. All the Brits out there did the same. You couldn't go to a party without someone getting on their mobile, and minutes later a motorbike dispatch rider would arrive with the little plastic bags. In the end, I stopped going to the parties. I've never taken drugs, and I didn't feel comfortable.
Ashley stirred on the sofa
and Martin scooped her up again. The child lolled happily in his arms.
I make it all sound awful, Grace continued, but that's only because I'm telling it now that it's all over. You can't be completely unhappy in Los Angeles, not when the sun is shining and the garden is full of bougainvillea. Damon never hurt me. He wasn't a bad man. He was just...
Selfish, Martin Lavelle finished the sentence.
Successful, Grace contradicted him. He was eaten up by success.
And now he's dead, Hawthorne said.
He glanced bleakly in her direction.
You might say that it couldn't have happened at a better time.
I don't know what you mean. Grace was angry. I would never say that. He was Ashley's father. She's going to grow up without ever knowing him.
I understand he left a will.
Grace faltered.
Yes?
Do you know what's in it?
Yes. His lawyer, Charles Kenworthy, was at the funeral and I asked him then. I had to know we're going to be secure, if only for Ashley's sake. I don't have to worry. He left everything to us.
He had life insurance.
I don't know about that.
I do, Grace.
Sitting there in his suit, with his legs crossed and his arms folded, Hawthorne was both at his most relaxed and at his most ruthless. His dark eyes were fixed on her, pinning her down.
He took out a policy 6 months ago. From what I understand, you'll get almost £1 million. Not to mention the flat in Brick Lane, the house in Hollywood Hills, the Alfa Romeo spider.
What are you saying, Mr. Hawthorne? Her father demanded. Do you think my daughter killed Damien?
Why not? From the sound of it, you wouldn't have been too sorry. And frankly, if I'd been stuck with him, I wouldn't have thought twice.
He turned back to Grace.
I noticed you arrived in England the day before Damien's mum died.
I hadn't had a chance to tell Hawthorne what I had found, looking through my notes. I was disappointed to hear he had got there without me.
Did you see her? He asked.
I was going to visit Diana, but Ashley was exhausted after the flight.
I suppose you were flying premium economy again. So you didn't go round?
No.
Grace was here with me, her father said. And I'll swear to that in a court of law if I have to, and when Damien was killed, she was still at the funeral.
And where were you during the funeral, Mr. Lavelle?
I was in Richmond Park with Ashley. I took her to see the deer. Hawthorne swung back to Grace.
When you were telling us about Rada, you said there was something more that you wanted to tell us about the girl who called herself Amanda Lee. What was that?
She was Damien's first girlfriend, but right at the end they split up. As a matter of fact, I think she left him for Dan Roberts. I saw them kissing just before we started rehearsing Hamlet. And I mean... kissing. They were completely into each other. She played Osric in the production, I told you that. Afterwards, she did quite well. She did a couple of big musicals, that was her speciality. The Lion King and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. But then she disappeared.
You mean she stopped working? I asked.
No, she disappeared. She went out for a walk one day, and she didn't come back. It was in all the newspapers. Nobody ever found out what happened to her.
A quick Google search on my iPhone outside Martin Lavelle's home produced the following newspaper report from 8 years before. South London Press, 18th of October 2003. Parents appeal as actress goes missing. A woman, 26, has gone missing from her home in Streatham, sparking a police search operation. Police officers are searching for Amanda Lee, an actress who has appeared in several major West End musicals, including The Lion King and Chicago. She is described as slim, with long fair hair, hazel eyes and freckles. Miss Lee left her flat early Sunday evening. She was smartly dressed in a grey silk trouser suit and carrying a dark blue Hermes Kelly handbag. Police were informed when she failed to appear for the Monday evening performance at the Lyceum Theatre. It has now been 6 days since she was last seen. Police have been talking to several internet dating agencies. The actress, who was single, was known to have met men online and could have been on her way to an assignation. Her parents have appealed for anyone who saw her that evening to come forward. I showed it to Hawthorne, who nodded as if it was exactly what he had expected to read. "So why are you interested in Amanda Lee?" I asked. He didn't answer. We were still standing in the middle of the estate, surrounded by identical houses and gardens, a few parked cars providing the only primary colours. Just then, another plane screamed overhead, its wheels lowered, its gigantic bulk blocking out the light. I waited for it to pass. "Are you going to tell me that Amanda Lee was also murdered? But she's got nothing to do with this. We never even heard of her before today." Hawthorne's phone rang. He held up a hand as he dug it out of his pocket and answered it. The conversation lasted about a minute, although Hawthorne barely said anything. Just, "Yes," two or three times, then, "Right," and, "Okay." Finally, he rang off. His face was grim.
"That was Meadows," he said.
"What's happened?"
"I've got to go back to Canterbury. He wants to talk to me."
"Why?" Hawthorne looked at me in a way that made me feel uneasy.
"Someone set fire to Nigel Weston's house last night," he said. "They poured petrol through the letterbox and set it alight."
"My God, is he dead?"
"No. He and his boyfriend got out all right. Weston is in hospital. He has smoke inhalation injuries, but nothing serious. He's going to be fine."
He looked at his watch.
"I'm going to get the train."
"I'll come with you," I said. He shook his head.
"No, I don't think you should. I'll go there alone."
"Why?" Another silence. I challenged him. "You know who was responsible for the fire, don't you?" I said. And there it was again, the bleakness in his eyes that I knew so well, and which somehow told me that he saw the world in a completely different way from me, and that we would never actually be close.
"Yes," he said. "You were."
21. Rada. I had no idea what Hawthorne meant, but the more I thought about it, the gloomier I became. How could I possibly have been responsible for an arson attack on Nigel Weston's home? I hadn't even known where he lived until I went there, and I hadn't spoken a word while Hawthorne, with his customary lack of tact, had laid into the older man. Nor had I told anyone we were planning to see him, apart from my wife, my assistant, and perhaps one of my sons. Was Hawthorne deliberately taking his anger out on me? It wouldn't have surprised me. Something had happened that he hadn't anticipated, so he had lashed out at whoever happened to be closest. I wondered where this left our inquiry. When he was at my flat, Hawthorne had more or less eliminated Alan Godwin from his investigation, and I thought I'd heard the last of the former judge, too. It was true that Weston's connection with Diana Cooper and the fact that he'd allowed her to walk free were troubling, but there was no proof that he had committed any crime. And yet now, he'd been attacked. Just when I was beginning to think that there was no connection between the murders and the car accident after all, the exact opposite had proved to be true. Diana Cooper had been driving the car that had killed Timothy Godwin and injured his brother. She had fled from the scene to protect her son, Damien Cooper. Judge Weston had let her off with the very lightest slap on the wrist. All three of them had been attacked, two of them fatally. That couldn't be a coincidence. But that raised another question. How did Amanda Lee, the girl who had acted with Damien Cooper at Rada and who had mysteriously disappeared, fit into all this? It might be, of course, that she didn't. I had been the one who had looked her up on my iPhone after we left Grace Lavelle's house, and although Hawthorne had read the newspaper article, he hadn't made any comment on it. So I couldn't be sure that it had any relevance at all. I was suddenly disgusted with myself. It was the middle of the afternoon, and I was sitting on my own in the cheap, garish cafe next to Hounslow East tube station, which I had entered after I had parted company with Hawthorne. He had taken the tube. I was surrounded by mirrors, illuminated menus, and widescreen TV showing some daytime antiques show. I had ordered two pieces of toast and a cup of tea, which I didn't actually want. What had happened to me? When I had first met Hawthorne, I had been a successful writer. I was the creator of a television show that was seen in 50 countries, and I also happened to be married to the producer. Hawthorne had worked for us. He had been paid £10 or £20 an hour to provide information which I had used in my scripts. But in just a couple of weeks, everything had changed. I had allowed myself to become a silent partner, a minor character in my own book. Worse than that, I had somehow persuaded myself that I couldn't work out a single clue without asking him what was going on. Surely I was cleverer than that. For too long, I'd been following in his footsteps. Now, with Hawthorne away, there was an opportunity for me to take the lead.
There was an oily sheen on the surface of my tea. The toast had been covered in a spread that had melted into something that might have come out of a car. I pushed the plate away and took out my phone. Hawthorne was going to be away for the rest of the day, which gave me plenty of time to investigate this new suspect, Amanda Lee. Oddly, there had been no photograph of her accompanying the article in the South London Press. I wondered what she looked like. There were no pictures that I could find on the net, and only a couple of other references to her. She had disappeared, and she had never been found. That was it. Her parents might still be grieving, but public interest had evaporated. I wanted to know more about her. If I really had been looking in the wrong direction all this time, which is to say in the direction of Deal, then it was time to find out what I had been missing. What could possibly have happened at RADA that might link Amanda, Damien and Diana Cooper, and how could it conceivably have led to murder? Even as I considered the question, it occurred to me that I had a way in. Occasionally, RADA invites actors, directors and screenwriters to come in and meet the students, and the year before, I'd talked to a whole bunch of them about that curious love triangle, actor-writer-script. Over the course of an hour, I tried to explain to them how a good actor will always find things in a script that the writer doesn't know are there, while a bad one will insert things that the writer would prefer they didn't. I talked to them about the way a character is created. Christopher Foyle, for example, existed on the page a long time before Michael Kitchen was cast, but only when that decision had been made did the real work begin. There was always a tension between the two of us. For example, Michael insisted almost from the start that Foyle would never ask questions, which made life difficult for me and seemed, to say the least, unusual for a detective. And yet it wasn't such a stupid idea. We found other, more original ways to get to the information that the plot demanded. Foyle had a way of insinuating himself, getting suspects to say more than they intended. In this way, year after year, the character developed. Anyway, I talked to the students about this and many other things, and I'm not sure how much they benefited from the session. I enjoyed it very much, though. There's nothing a writer likes more than talking about writing. I'd been invited by an associate director. I'll call her Liz, as she's asked not to be identified. I telephoned her from the cafe. Fortunately, she happened to be at RADA that afternoon and agreed to see me for an hour at 3 o'clock. Liz is a smart, rather intense woman, a few years older than me. She had trained to be an actor herself, but had ended up writing and directing. She had gone back into teaching following a bruising encounter with the press. This had involved a play about British Sikhs, which she had directed. Though well-intentioned, it had led to riots, with two local councillors, she had told me they had neither read nor seen the work, whipping the crowds into a fury. The artistic director had grovelled, the play had been cancelled. Nobody had come to Liz's defence. Even now, many years later, she prefers to remain anonymous. RADA's main building on Gower Street is an odd place. The entrance, with its two statues of comedy and tragedy sculpted by Alan Durst in the 1920s, is both imposing and barely noticeable. The narrow door leads into a building that seems far too small for the three theatres, offices, rehearsal rooms, craft shops and so on that it contains. I remembered it as being a maze of white corridors and staircases, with swing doors everywhere, so that on my first visit, I felt a little like a laboratory rat. This time, I met Liz in the rather chic new cafe on the ground floor. "I remember Damien Cooper very well," she told me. We'd both sat down with cappuccinos, surrounded by black and white photographs of the current third year. There were a few other students at the tables around us, chatting or reading scripts. She kept her voice low. "I always had a feeling he'd do well. He was a cocky little sod, though." "I didn't realise you were teaching here then," I said. "It was 1997. I just joined. Damien would have been in his second year." "You didn't like him?" "I wouldn't say that. I try to keep my feelings about all the students under wraps. The trouble with this place is that everyone is super sensitive and you can all too easily get accused of favouritism. I'm just telling you the facts. He was very ambitious. He'd have stabbed his own mother if it would help him get cast." She considered what she'd just said. "That's not very appropriate, is it, given the circumstances? But you know what I mean. Did you see his Hamlet?" "Yes. And he was absolutely wonderful. I almost hate to admit it. He only got the part because the boy who was cast got glandular fever. We had a bit of an epidemic that year, and for a while the whole place was like London during the Great Plague. Of course, he'd wanted the lead from the very start. He did it for his tree, which was his way of showing off. Actually, you know, you were right, what you said a moment ago. I didn't like him. He had a way of manipulating people, which I thought was a little creepy. And then there was that business in Deal. What about it? I was suddenly interested. Was there a link between the car accident and the drama school, which Hawthorne didn't know about, and which we had both missed? Well, it's just that he used it in one of the acting classes. We were exploring what we called public solitude, and the students had to bring in an object that mattered to them in some way, and talk about it in front of their classmates. She paused. He brought in a plastic toy, a London bus. He also played us a recording of a song, a nursery rhyme. The wheels on the bus go round and round, you must know it. He told us it had been played at the funeral of the little boy who'd been killed in the accident, when his mother had been driving the car. What exactly was creepy? I asked. I actually had a bit of a set to with him afterwards. He was very emotional about it. He said the song had torn him to shreds, that he couldn't get it out of his head, all that sort of stuff. But the truth is, I didn't feel he was really connected to what had happened. I felt he was using it, almost like a prop. His monologue was too self-centred. In a way, that was the object of the exercise, but in this case, an 8-year-old boy had died. Damien's mother might not have been entirely responsible, but she had killed him. I didn't think it was appropriate to use it in class, and I told him so. What can you tell me about Amanda Lee? I asked. I remember her less well. She was very talented, but quiet. She and Damien went out for a while, and they were very close. I'm afraid she didn't have very much of a career after she left. A couple of musicals, but nothing much else. She sighed. That's the way it happens sometimes. You can never really predict which way it's going to go. And then she disappeared. It was in the newspapers, and we even had the police asking questions here, although her disappearance must have been 4 or 5 years after she left. There was some talk that she'd gone to meet a fan, you know, a stalker. Although later on the police changed their minds and said it was probably someone she was dating. She dressed up smartly, and her flatmate said she was in a good mood when she left. She was sharing a place somewhere in South London. Streatham. That's right. Anyway, she went out, and she was never seen again. Maybe there would have been more fuss about it if she'd been more famous. Or if anyone had made the connection between her and Damien Cooper. He was already making quite a name for himself. But I suppose lots of people go missing in London, and she was just another of them. You said you had a picture? Yes. You're lucky, because there are far fewer photographs from that time. These days, of course, everyone has phones, but we kept this because of the Hamlet. She had brought a large canvas bag with her and lifted it onto the table. I found it in the office. She took out a framed black-and-white photograph, which she laid between the coffee cups, and I found myself looking through a window into 1999. There were 5 young actors, posing with almost exaggerated seriousness for the camera on a bare stage. I recognised Damien Cooper immediately. He hadn't changed very much in 12 years. Back then, he had been slimmer and prettier. Cocky was exactly the word that sprang to mind. He was looking straight into the lens, his eyes challenging you to ignore him. He was dressed in black jeans and a black open-necked shirt, holding a white Japanese mask. Grace Lavelle, who had played Ophelia, and the boy who had played Laertes, were standing on either side of them. They both had fans spread out over their heads. That's Amanda. Liz pointed to a girl with long hair, tied back, standing just behind them. She was playing a male part and was wearing the same clothes as Damien. I have to say that her photograph disappointed me. I'm not sure what I'd been expecting, but she looked quite ordinary. Pretty, freckled, hair tied back in a ponytail. She was standing on the very edge of the group, her head turned towards a man who was approaching from the side. "Who's that?" I asked. The man had barely entered the frame, and I couldn't make out his face. He was black, wearing glasses, holding a bunch of flowers, noticeably older than the others. "I've no idea," Liz said. "He's probably one of the parents. The photograph was taken after the first performance, and the GBS was packed." "Did you ever..." I was about to ask her something about Amanda's relationship with Damien, but it was just then that I saw something and stopped mid-sentence. I was looking at one of the people in the photograph, and quite suddenly, I knew who it was. There could be no doubt of it. And with a rush of excitement, I realised that I had discovered something that might be important, and that just for once, I was one step ahead of Hawthorne. I knew something he didn't. He had deliberately taunted me when we left Grace Lavelle's home, and all along he had treated me with an indifference that sometimes edged close to contempt. Well,
How amusing would it be if I was able to tell him what he'd missed when he got back from Canterbury? I couldn't help smiling. It would be a delicious payback for all those hours following him around London, watching silently from the sidelines. "Liz, you've been brilliant," I said. "I don't suppose I can borrow this." I was referring to the photograph. "Ah, sorry, it can't leave the building. But you can take a picture of it, if you like." "That's great." My iPhone had been on the table, recording our conversation. I picked it up and took a shot of the image. I stood up. "Thanks a lot." Outside RADA, I made 3 telephone calls. First, I arranged a meeting. Then I called my assistant, who was waiting for me at my office. I told her I wouldn't be coming back this afternoon. Finally, I left a message for my wife, saying I might be a bit late for dinner. In fact, I wouldn't have dinner at all. 22. Behind the Mask. From Gower Street, I took the tube back out to West London and walked down to a square, red-brick building on the Fulham Palace Road, just 5 minutes from Hammersmith Roundabout. It's no longer there, by the way. It was knocked down when they constructed a brand-new office block, Elsinore House. By a weird coincidence, HarperCollins are based there. They publish the American editions of my books. The building that I visited that day was deliberately discreet, with frosted glass windows and no signage at all. When I rang the front doorbell, I was greeted by an angry buzz and a click as the lock was electronically released from somewhere inside. A CCTV camera watched as I entered an empty reception area with bare walls and a tiled floor. It reminded me of a clinic or some obscure department of a hospital, though perhaps one that had recently closed down. At first I thought I was alone, but then a voice called out to me and I went into an office just round the corner, where the funeral director, Robert Cornwallis, was making 2 cups of coffee. The office was as unremarkable as the rest of the building, with a desk and a collection of very utilitarian chairs, padded without being remotely comfortable. A coffee machine stood on a trestle table to one side. There was a calendar on the wall. This was the facility that Cornwallis had mentioned when we first met. His clients came to South Kensington for consultations, but the actual bodies were brought here. Somewhere close by there was a chapel, a place of bereavement, Irene Laws had called it. Certainly this wasn't it, for the room I had entered offered no solace at all. I listened out for other people. It had never occurred to me that we might be alone, but it was late afternoon by now, and perhaps everyone had gone home. I had actually telephoned Cornwallis in his office, but he had insisted on meeting me here. He greeted me by name, and as I came in and sat down, he seemed warmer and more relaxed than the last 2 occasions I had seen him. He was wearing a suit, but had taken off the tie and undone the top 2 buttons of his shirt. "I had no idea who you were," he said, passing me one of the cups of coffee. I'd given him my name over the phone. "You're a writer." "I have to say I'm quite surprised. When you came to my office, and my house, I had assumed you were working with the police." "I am, in a way," I replied. "No, I mean, I thought you were a detective. Where is Mr. Hawthorne?" I drank some of the coffee. He had added sugar without asking me. "He's out of London at the moment."
"And he sent you?"
"No. To be honest, he doesn't know I'm seeing you." Cornwallis considered this. He looked puzzled.
"On the telephone you said you were working on a book?"
"Yes."
"Isn't that a little unorthodox? I thought a police inquiry, a murder inquiry, would be conducted in private. Will I be appearing in this book of yours?"
"I think you might," I said. "I'm not sure that I want to. This whole business with Diana Cooper and her son has been extremely upsetting, and I really don't want the company dragged into it. As a matter of fact, I'm sure you'll find quite a few of the parties involved may have objections." "I suppose I'll have to get their permission. And if anyone really does object, I can always change their name." I might have added that there was nothing to stop me writing about real people if they were in the public domain, but I didn't want to antagonize him.
"Would you prefer it if I changed yours?" I asked.
"I'm afraid I'd insist on it."
"I could call you Dan Roberts."
He looked at me curiously. A smile spread across his face.
That's a name I haven't used for years.
I know.
He took out a packet of cigarettes. I didn't know that he smoked, although now I thought about it, there had been an ashtray of some sort in his office. He lit a cigarette and shook out the match with an angry wave of the hand.
You mentioned on the telephone that you were calling from RADA.
That's right, I said. I was there this afternoon. I was seeing... I told him the name of the associate director. He didn't seem to recognize it.
You never told me that you went to RADA, I added.
I'd drunk half of the coffee. I set the mug down.
I'm sure I did.
No.
I was there on both occasions when Hawthorne spoke to you. Not only were you at RADA, but you were there at the same time as Damian Cooper.
You acted with him.
I was sure he would deny it, but he didn't blink.
I never talk about RADA anymore. It's not a part of my life that I remember with any great fondness, and from what you yourself told me, I didn't think it was relevant. When you came to see me in my South Kensington office, you made it quite clear that your investigation, or should I say Mr. Hawthorne's investigation, was directed towards the car accident that had taken place in Deal.
There may still be a connection, I said.
Were you there when Damien talked about it? Apparently, he used it as the basis of one of his acting classes.
As a matter of fact, I was. It was a long time ago, of course, and I'd forgotten all about it until you brought it up.
He came around the side of the desk and perched on the edge, hovering over me. There was a harsh neon light in the room, and it reflected in his glasses.
He brought in a little red bus, and he played the music. He talked about what had happened and the impression it made on him.
Robert Cornwallis reflected for a moment.
Do you know, he was actually quite proud of the fact that immediately after she had run over two children, killing one of them as it turned out, his mother's thoughts were entirely focused on him and his career. The two of them were really quite remarkable, wouldn't you agree?
You acted with him, I said.
You were in Hamlet.
The No production. Based on Japanese classical theatre. All masks and fans and shared experience. Ridiculous, really.
We were just children with big ideas about ourselves, but at the time it mattered more than you can possibly imagine.
Everyone says you were brilliant, I said.
He shrugged.
There was a time when I wanted to be an actor.
But you became an undertaker.
We discussed this when you were at my house. It was the family business. My father, my grandfather, remember?
He seemed to have an idea.
There's something I'd like to show you. You may find it interesting.
What is it?
Not here. Next door.
He stood up, expecting me to follow. And that was what I meant to do. But when I tried to get to my feet, I discovered that I couldn't.
Actually, that's not even the half of it. What I'm describing was, without question, the single most terrifying moment of my life. I couldn't move. My brain was sending a signal to my legs, get up, but my legs weren't listening. My arms had become foreign objects, attached to me, but not connected. I was aware of my head, perched like a football, on a body that had turned into a useless pile of muscle and bone, and somewhere inside, my heart was hammering away in panic, as if it could somehow break free. I will never fully be able to describe the bowel-emptying fear I felt at that moment. I knew that I had been drugged, and that I was in terrible danger.
"Are you all right?"
Cornwallis asked, his face full of concern.
"What have you done?"
Even my voice didn't sound like me. My mouth was having to work twice as hard to form the words.
"Stand up."
"I can't."
And then he smiled. It was a horrible smile. Moving very slowly, he came over to me. I flinched as he took out a handkerchief and forced it into my mouth, effectively gagging me. It hadn't even occurred to me, until then, that I really ought to have screamed, not that it would have made any difference. I knew now that he had made sure we were on our own.
"I'm just going to get something, I won't be a minute," he said.
He walked out of the room, leaving the door open. I sat there, exploring my new sensations, or rather, my lack of them. I couldn't feel anything except fear. I tried to slow my breathing. My heart was still pounding. The handkerchief was pressing against the back of my throat, half suffocating me. I was actually too terrified to work out what should have been obvious to me, that I had blithely walked into a place of death, and that my own death was almost certain to be the result. Cornwallis came back pushing a wheelchair. Perhaps he used it for corpses, although it was more likely that he kept it for the elderly relatives who came to pay their last respects for the departed. He was whistling quietly to himself, and there was a curious, empty quality to his face. He was no longer wearing his tinted glasses, and I looked at his twinkling eyes, his neat little beard, his thinning hair, with the knowledge that they were nothing more than a mask, and that they had concealed something quite monstrous, which was now showing through. He knew I couldn't move. He must have put something in my coffee, and I, fool that I was, had drunk it. Already I was screaming at myself. This was the man who had strangled Diana Cooper and had sliced up her son. But why? And why hadn't I worked it out, hadn't it been obvious, before I came here? He leant down, and for a moment I thought he was going to kiss me. I recoiled in disgust, but he simply picked me up and dumped me in the wheelchair. I weigh about 85 kilograms, and the effort made him pause for breath. Then he brushed himself off, straightened my legs, and, still whistling, wheeled me out of the office. We went past an open door with a chapel on the other side. I glimpsed candles, wood panels, an altar that might be equipped with a cross, a menorah, or whatever religious icon was appropriate. At the end of the corridor, there was an industrial lift, large enough to hold a coffin. He pushed me in and stabbed at a button. As the doors closed, I felt my entire life being shut off behind me. There was a jolt, and we began our descent. The lift opened directly into a large, low-ceilinged workroom with more neon lights evenly spaced. Everything I saw filled me with fresh horror, intensified by the fact that I was completely helpless. At the far end, there were 6 silver cabinets, refrigerated compartments arranged in 2 sets of 3, each one large enough to hold a human body. A whole side of the room was given over to what looked like a basic surgery with a metal gurney, shelves containing darkly coloured bottles and vials, a table with an array of scalpels, needles and knives. He parked me so that I was facing them with my back to the lift. The walls were whitewashed brick. The floor was covered in grey sheet vinyl. There was a bucket in one corner and a mop. "I really wish you hadn't come here," Cornwallis said. He still had that very reasonable, mannered way of speaking, which he had cultivated over the years and which suited the role he had taken. Because I knew now that it was just a role. With every second that passed, the real Robert Cornwallis was revealing himself to me. "I've got nothing against you, and I don't want to hurt you, but you made the decision to come here and poke your nose into my fucking business!" His voice had risen as he completed the sentence, so that by the time he reached the swear word, it was a high-pitched scream. He recovered himself a little. "Why did you have to ask about Rada?" he went on. "Why did you have to go digging around in the past? You come here asking me these stupid questions, and I have to tell you, and then I have to deal with you, which I really don't want to do." I tried to speak, but the handkerchief prevented me. He pulled it out of my mouth. As soon as it came free, I found my voice. "I told my wife I was coming here," I said, "and my assistant. If you do anything to me, they'll know." "If they ever find you," Cornwallis replied. His voice was matter of fact. I was about to speak again, but he held up a hand. "I don't care. I don't want to hear anything more from you. It doesn't really make any difference to me anymore. But I do just want to explain." He touched his fingertips to the side of his head, staring into the mid-distance as he gathered his thoughts. And I just sat there, silently screaming. "I am a writer. This can't happen to me. I didn't ask for any of it." "Do you have any idea what my life has been like?" Cornwallis said at last. "Do you think I enjoy my job? What do you think it's like? Sitting day after day after day, listening to miserable people going on about their miserable dead mothers and fathers and grannies and grandpas, arranging funerals and cremations and coffins and headstones while the sun is shining and everyone else is getting on with their lives. People look at me and they see this boring man in a suit who never smiles and who says all the right things. My condolences. Oh, I'm so sorry. Please let me offer you a tissue. When inside I actually want to punch them in the face, because that's not me. And it's not who I ever wanted to be. Cornwallis and Sons. That's what I was born into. My father was an undertaker. My grand